Insperity presents the Small Business Advocate Show with Jim Blasingame. This is a copyrighted production of Small Business Network, Inc. All rights reserved.
Get your motor running. We're back. It's 12 after. I'm Jim Blasingame, the Small Business Advocate, and we're about to visit with our good friend Joan Pryde, senior editor with the Kipling Editors. We're not doing it yet because she's not here yet, but she is here. You just haven't talked to her yet. Joan, welcome back.
Hey, Jim. Good morning.
Hi.
Hi.
How are you? It's good to have you back.
Thank you.
And as I'm sure, it's great for you to be here, right?
I'm thrilled.
It's like
every
a dream
time
come,
I'm here.
It's a dream come true, isn't it? Pretty
much.
Oh,
yeah. You
Joan,
keep believing that.
Joan, as you cast your gaze out over the electoral landscape,
yes.
as you are wont to do from time to time,
yeah,
are you? What are voters telling you? What are your many connections telling you that voters think about this big, huge deficit that some people are so worried about?
Well, for me, it's a big worry.
It's a big story.
Worry.
It's a big worry.
Yeah.
You're worried about the deficit?
Well, I'm surprised that a Republican would not be.
I'm not worried about the deficit.
Why not?
Now, wait a minute. Why do you call me a Republican? I've never told you I'm a Republican.
That's true. It's just a wild guess.
Just a wild guess. Well, I'm not worried about the deficit because now in about 3 or 4 years, if we haven't gotten it under control, I might be. But the reason I'm not worried about the deficit, and I'm one of the guys that you're.
Kiplinger's telling you not to worry about
well,
it. Because
you know,
it's just a budget deficit isn't a worry
now. You know me, I walk the Kiplinger line, sure. No, the reason I'm not worried about it is because we still don't know. Actually, I know, but many people don't know how much of an impact the entrepreneurial 21st century in America is going to how much production it's going to create when we just get the government out of our way.
Well, the government's in our way with its big deficit.
Well, the deficit? Well, no, I don't think so. Well, tell us how it is. How is the government in the way with the deficit?
Well, when the deficit is higher, then borrowing costs go up.
Right. Okay. But so far they haven't gone up, right?
Well, not yet. But let's talk about the Fed for a minute. Maybe we have something to say about that.
All right. So tell us about. Oh, you mean later on? Okay.
Well, we could talk about it now. I'd be happy to.
Well, the Fed didn't raise
your show, Jim.
The Fed didn't raise rates, Joan.
No, but they said something that made everybody think they're going to.
The stock market didn't like that either, did they?
Yes, that's right.
Well, but the stock market will get over it today.
Probably.
And what happens, folks, as you may know, especially those of you who listen to my Fed Watch show, which we have the day before the Fed meets every time, before the Federal Open Market Committee meets, is the Fed has two different ways of sending a message. Number one is the blunt end of their stick, which is to raise rates. But the other, more subtle end, is where they just say, well, you know, we didn't raise rates, but we're leaning toward it if something doesn't change. And it's the
language. And this is a relatively new phenomenon that they make these little comments that they they're hinting at future action. And the famous hint a few months ago was when the Fed said that they felt that rates could stay low for a considerable period.
Yeah.
And the markets have spent all this time trying to define what a considerable period means. You know, the Fed is never going to say, we'll keep rates low for the next 6 months. They would never do that.
How could they have fun otherwise?
Right, exactly. But now they've changed their wording, and they've actually said something that's got everybody wondering what this means now. They said that they can be, quote, patient, unquote, about raising rates.
Mm-hmm.
That sounds good to me, but the markets didn't like it.
Look, I don't know why everybody's getting all excited. The Fed's going to raise rates one time, a quarter point this year. That's it, period.
I think Kiplinger agrees
with me on this, Joan.
Really?
Didn't you guys say that?
Yes, I think so.
I think you guys said that. And, of course, I said it first, but anyway. No, the deficit is, there are two aspects of the deficit, Joan. As you know, one is the immediate deficit as a result of spending for Homeland Security, for the war in Iraq, the temporary things, or at least I should say the new things. That's one part of the deficit. Then there's something that my economists call what they call the structural deficit. And that's the deficit that's a result of the current revenue model of the country.
Well, and it's part of things that can't change because they're written into the law,
right,
such as entitlements.
Right.
And also interest on the debt. You can't just cancel interest on the debt unless you want to go into bankruptcy. You have to keep that's still going to be on your books until you finish paying it.
And with the tax cuts that the president got into law and is trying to make permanent, he got into law last year. When you do the math on that revenue model, it creates the deficit that they're projecting. But here's the thing, Joan, that they don't take into consideration, and that is the supply side effect, and that's the ability for the economy to grow its way out of the deficit, actually earn enough, you know, to be successful, for this country to become prosperous enough that it can either completely eradicate or at least largely eradicate the deficit.
Well, let's hope that can happen.
Well, I you called me a Republican a while ago, and I've never said that whether I was or not, but I will tell you, I am a supply-sider, so if that makes me a Republican, then guilty as charged. But I do believe
I figured you for an independent that goes your own way, really.
Well, but I do believe in the power of the marketplace, and I believe that if we get in America, at least, not in Europe, not in Japan, not in China, not in Iraq, but in America, I believe if the government gets out of the way of entrepreneurs, that a whole lot of financial and economic ills will be solved. That's what I believe.
Well, I hope it happens.
But you guys say that the economy, Kiplinger actually says when the economy picks up steam, as it is, that this is going to help the deficit. But as you also say, it could hurt the borrowing power, right? I mean, as far as interest rates are concerned.
Right, and then you have to worry that there could be rates going up even higher if inflation worries return. I can't see inflation worries returning anytime soon.
Why are they still worrying about that? I mean, I don't know. I mean, I know it's something
we were traumatized.
We have to watch for that. We have to watch for inflation, no question about it. We have to be diligent against inflation. But
right. But
two things that aren't on the immediate horizon, Joan, and that is a problem from the deficit on the immediate horizon, a problem with the deficit, interest rates, and inflation. Those three are not really 2004 problems, and that's a problem for the Democrats, isn't it, Joan?
Well, we'll see.
Yeah. Stand by. 20 after. We'll be right back with Joan, the recalcitrant Joan Pride, right after these messages. 20 after. Stay with us.
Sound of the river, you stop and you hold everything. A band is blowing Dixie.
We're back, 23 after. I'm Jim Blasingame, the Small Business Advocate, and we're visiting with our good friend Joan Pride, Senior Editor with the Kiplinger Editors. Joan, we were talking about the deficit. Mr. Bush says that by the time he's out of office in 08, he expects the deficit to be down to around 2%. But you guys say it's probably not going to get that far down, right? It's going to probably be more like about 3.
I think, yes,
3%,
around 3%
of the gross domestic product.
Right.
Yeah. And, you know, Joan, we've got a $7 trillion debt, and a lot of people are upset about that. They don't think we've got too much debt. But, you know, Joan, what you've got to do, to me, it seems, is we've got to look at that debt as compared to our national assets and our national ability to generate revenue. And if you look at the company like you do, the country like you do a company, that's like a... You know, that would be an excellent. Any company who had the debt to equity ratio that this country has, that would be considered to be, if you were a public company, you'd be considered to be a takeover target.
Well, I guess the answer to that for me is sort of turning one of your favorite phrases on your head, is that it may not be a problem now, but we don't like the direction.
Now, I don't disagree with that, because it's $7 trillion now, and the last number I saw, I remember seeing a few, you know, I don't know, 4 or 5 years ago, was 5%. So, no,
right.
I mean 5 trillion, not 7 trillion. Actually, I think it was 5.5.
It just seems to me there's got to come a point where it does hurt us.
You're right. No, you're right about that. We do need to turn that around. But I will say, I still say, that I'm going to stand by what I said earlier, and that is that we've got to give the economy an opportunity to respond, and then let's see how the economy's doing, and then we'll make the adjustments. But one good thing, Joan, in this financial issue that we're talking about here, is it is giving legislators some pause to spend money. I mean, it is letting them know that they can't. That they're now, I think, hopefully now we're getting their attention a little bit on how much money they can spend, and I think we're going to talk about that in a minute. What the president's going to do about that? Let's move on down though and talk about Social Security.
But I'd just like to interject one thing.
Okay.
You can't say it both ways. On the one hand, we've already said that the main problem isn't domestic discretionary spending, but on the other hand, it's not fair to say, well, you guys have to lower your discretionary domestic spending to help the deficit, because that ain't going to do a whole lot.
But Joan, I didn't say that. I do believe that it is.
No, I'm not saying
spending.
You did, but yeah. I'm just, in case you were going there.
No. I definitely think it's discretionary spending. I'm just saying that the deficit hopefully will hold them down, and the president's going to deal with that a little, in which we will deal with.
Well, when you say hold them down, what do you mean?
Veto.
No, but I mean hold who down from doing what?
The whole Congress down. He hasn't vetoed a single
saying.
Bill.
Their domestic discretionary spending isn't what is fueling the deficit.
It partially is, Joan.
In a very, very small amount. We've just spent all this time saying that the structural deficit is the big part of the deficit.
I don't think I
and the tax cut and the spending on terrorism.
But the structural part of the structural deficit, Joan, is the spending.
Well, but the spending that's structural is the entitlements. That's not discretionary.
Yeah. I see what you mean. Well, and that is the problem, which brings me to this next point, and that is that Kiplinger says that Social Security will eventually be partially privatized. Tell us what you mean by that.
Well, it means that they're going to come up with some way to have people set up their own accounts that they manage that they're really responsible for, so that Social Security isn't 100% funded by the government.
Right. We've got to head in that direction, Joan. We're doing that now with HSAs, the new health savings accounts. Which we talked about earlier in the show with Grace Marie Turner. HSAs, Joan, you and I have talked about the importance of portability. HSAs give us that first step. We've got to do the same thing with Social Security, don't we?
Oh, no question about it. I don't know how we're going to do it, though. It's going to be very difficult.
See, Joan, I'm not so much worried about the deficit, the operating deficit of the government, as much as I am the entitlements, Medicare, Medicaid, and Social Security.
Well, the administration, backed by Congress, just approved a whole new add-on to Medicare.
$400 billion. You know, you're right about that. Unfortunately, that's what it took to get HSAs. And so, anyway, well, you know, Joan, one of the ugliest things in nature is politics, I guess. Let's move over and talk about the economy a little bit. The economy is doing well, Joan, and you guys recognize that, but you also say that there's still a dearth of new jobs. Now, tell us what a dearth of new jobs means.
There are not a whole lot of new jobs out there. But again, I hate to keep pounding away at the same theme, but the job picture is always sort of the last piece of the puzzle that gets into place. You know, and the jobs figures are therefore known as a lagging economic indicator. So when people see the economy getting better but a dearth of jobs, they start to worry. And so we should be getting more jobs. On the other hand, there is still the problem of offshore jobs and jobs being moved overseas, and that's mm-hmm. something that is sort of, in a sense, structural to this economy now. So I'm not sure what the job creation levels are going to be.
Joan, remember when the Fed didn't know what to do in the 90s? They were getting all this new productivity information in. They didn't know what to do with it, and
they wouldn't believe it hardly.
They were afraid it was going to be inflationary, and they raised rates, and they kind of hurt the economy. Remember that?
Right. Oh, yeah.
We're having that same kind of a situation right now with employment because of the global movement of jobs around the earth, and the some jobs becoming obsolete and you know, literally going away. All the changes, we're having to look at employment in all around the world, not just in America, but all around the world in a new way. And when we come back, I'd like to pick up on this a little bit more and get your thoughts on this, which we're going to do right after these messages at 29 after. Stay with me. I'll be right back with Joan Pryde.
You You're listening to a man whose work is never done.
In a job like yours, even when it's finished, there's always one more thing to do.
And his job is to make your job easier.
It's a very difficult job, and the only way to get through it is we all work together as a team. And that means you do everything I say.
He's Jim Blassingame, the Small Business Advocate.
We're back. It's 34 after. Thanks for hanging around with me. Thanks for hanging around and listening to our good friend Joan Pride, who always does everything I say. She's senior editor with the Kiplinger Editors. Joan, you guys got a website, don't you?
Well, absolutely, we do. www.kiplinger.com.
K-I-P-L-I-N-G-E-R. It's really easy to spell, just like Blassingame. Just don't try to make anything out of it. Just spell it like it sounds. And there's a lot of free stuff on that website, too, folks. And I also want to encourage you to check out their publications, because small business owners have been benefiting from their publications for over 80 years now. And the flagship letter is the Kiplinger letter, the one we work off of every week. And that comes weekly. And then they also have the three biweekly letters, the California letter, the tax letter, and the agriculture letter. And then of course, Joan will tell you about the magazine.
Well, many years ago, it was known as Changing Times, but now it's Kiplinger's Personal Finance Magazine.
Yeah, and of course, you've seen that on newsstands, too, folks, in bookstores. So check those out, and don't forget, as far as I know, there's still a 30-day free trial.
I believe so.
Yeah, you can check it out, and if you don't like it after 30 days, they'll say sayonara if you want to do that. So check it out when you get a chance. Joan.
And can we give the toll-free number?
Oh, yes. I'm sorry. Yes, please do.
All right. It's 800-544-0155.
Yeah, if you don't want to go online and subscribe, you can call that number. And
sure can.
So check that
Mention
out.
Mention Jim's name and see how fast they hang up.
Absolutely.
No, just tease. Sorry.
Joan, I want to get back to this jobs thing. This is really important. I think this is, if I could say to anybody in America, if I could sit them down and have a conversation with them about anything, I think it would be about jobs, because I think this is the most misunderstood element of the political and the economic landscape. Would you disagree or agree with me on that?
In terms of
people not understanding about the different elements that are impacting unemployment.
Well, I can understand that, but I guess one of the problems is if you're a person and you're in danger of losing your job, or if you have lost your job, that you're not going to want to hear any of our optimistic talk.
You're not going to want to be philosophical about that. I agree with you.
Exactly.
No question. But still, but notwithstanding that, what I'm getting at is it's not fair to blame a Republican or a Democrat for what's happening with the employment situation, because if a job is going to... For example, let's take these big companies. Let's take Daimler Chrysler, you know, or let's take General Motors. Now, General Motors is based in the U.S., but it's an international company.
That's
true. They do
true.
Business all over the world.
Right.
So why can't that company employ some people in India that they used to employ in the U.S.?
I don't see why not.
But the thing is, that's happening because it's easier to do that now.
Right.
And but yet a company like General Motors, for example, might get stung in America because they moved those jobs over there and somebody in America lost their job. Look, I'm not indifferent to Americans losing their job. It's not that I don't care about that. It's just that we have to be realistic about what's happening in the 21st century.
Well, I agree, but we need to figure out what to do with these people. You know, do we retrain
them?
How do we move them into... You know, I was just reading in the paper today, the old Domino Sugar plant in Williamsburg, Brooklyn, is closing. I mean, there's people that have worked there for 30, 35 years, and they don't know what they're going to do because they're not trained to do anything else.
Those people, you hit it right on the head, Joan. That's the political issue.
And they're left behind by the service economy.
The political issue is not, oh, my God, somebody caused us to lose these jobs. The political issue to me is, what are we doing for those people that did lose their job?
Right.
And I agree with you. You hit it right on the head. And that's the thing that we have to realize, Joan, that is that our own intellect has created the technology and the capability to allow these jobs to move around the earth. And guess what, Joan? If they can move to India, they can move back to America just as easier, maybe even easier.
I don't see why not.
That could happen in 5 or 10 years.
Right, and you don't have the stranglehold that the unions used to have on the economy.
Exactly.
So
right.
I would think it would be possible.
it's going to take some time. The thing is, Joan, I believe that we are in a 10 to 20 year period, a generational period, where there's going to be some pain because of the way the jobs are moving around the globe. Until we can settle all this down and get it kind of evened out and people get retrained, as you say, it's going to be like this, and there's not anything
sure.
we can do about it.
Yeah.
Stand by. There's not really anything we should do about it. It's
right.
a natural thing. Quick break, 20 till. We'll be right back with our good friend Joan Pryde, senior editor with the Kiplinger Editor. Stay with us. We're back at 17 till. I'm Jim Blasingame, the Small Business Advocate. Thanks for hanging around with us today. I appreciate it very much. Let me remind you, we've got Floyd Hurt coming up. Wild and crazy Floyd Hurt will be with us in our next show. And also Chuck Cadlick, one of our top economic experts. Looking forward to getting both of those guys on the show. And I'll tell you more about the rest of the show later on. Joan Pryde is our guest. She's senior editor with the Kiplinger Editors. Joan, Mr. Bush has really been pretty accommodative in a lot of ways to the Democrats in his 3.5 years or so. Witness the Medicare bill that we mentioned earlier. I mean, and if anybody doubts what I just said, Joan, the man has not wielded one single veto.
Well, I would think he wouldn't have to with the Republicans controlling both houses of Congress,
well,
wouldn't you?
Well, yeah, but you'd also think that at least at some point in time that he would see something he didn't like. But the other thing is you guys
maybe he's
say,
just scared.
You guys say that the gloves are going to be off in election year, though, that he's not going to be accommodative at all to the Democrats. He's going to play a little bit rougher with them.
Right. And thinking back to his father, you know, his famous deals with the Democratic Congress on taxes didn't help him at all.
That cost him the election.
Well, that's sure. That's exactly. The famous "read my lips" remark, and then mm-hmm. going back on that. So, I think George Bush the son is taking a lesson from that, and is going to be a lot more hard nosed than he has been in the past.
Well, even though you say, and you rightly say that he didn't. Why would he veto something against the Republicans? It's just that the Democrats do have, the Republicans do only have a very slim majority in both houses, and the slimmest of slim majorities in Senate. And
right.
so it's not like, you know, they can just run roughshod over the Democrats, but
despite their best efforts.
Yeah. but you guys say he's going to be playing hardball, and also, you know, it's not really going to help him to play nice with the Democrats, because they're not going to give him any slack this year either, are they?
Well, if you think about it, let's say he does play nice, and this probably holds true for the other party as well. If you play nice and you come up with some good legislation, heaven forbid, then you worry about who's going to really get the credit.
Mm-hmm.
Instead of saying, let's have good government and going ahead and writing the good legislation, people, and I'm saying this, I'm not just saying Republicans, Democrats will want to do this too. They'll be more concerned about scoring political points. That's why you have a lot of trouble, more trouble than normal, passing legislation in an election year.
Hasn't Mr. Bush taken a little bit of a play out of the taking a page out of the Bill Clinton playbook with regard to glomming on to the other side's issues at the strategic moment?
Ah, the old triangulation issue.
Yeah. Well, yes. You know, Bill Clinton.
Yes, he sure has.
Bill Clinton was drug kicking, screaming towards welfare reform, but he did it.
That's right.
And when he did it, he's still taking credit for it, even though he didn't
and
want to do it.
No,
so,
but it earned him a lot of political points.
Look what the Medicare
yep.
bill's going to do for Bush.
Well,
for
and
Bush.
I think Karl Rove, Bush's political guru, made it clear to him that if you don't come out of this with a bill, you're going to be pounded on by
yep.
the Democrats in the
yep.
election year.
Exactly. And so he's basically co-opted. He's done something that Clinton was the best at,
and he
co-opting the opposition.
Also co-opting members of his own party. Clinton
yep.
upset a lot of people in his own party by agreeing to welfare reform, and it's a good analogy. Because Bush upset a lot of conservatives
yep.
by agreeing to this whole new section of welfare being added to the program. Now, they tried to appease them by getting some reforms in there, but I don't think they felt that there were enough.
And, Joan, evidence of that is that all he wants to talk about the Medicare bill is the HSAs, which was
right.
the really good part of the Medicare bill.
Right.
So that's where he's spending a lot
absolutely.
Of time. He made
right.
a major speech yesterday in the White House
right.
on this issue. Joan, let's move on down and talk about technology. Identity thieving, identity stealing is really becoming a big deal right now by identity theft on the Internet, isn't it?
Yeah, and it's scary. And especially now, it's good. Well, this isn't an example of ID theft, but it just popped into my mind. You have these crazy new worms that you think are legitimate,
right.
but they're not. And now we're saying seemingly legitimate websites will lure you in and get you to post your personal data
mm-hmm.
and then use it to steal your identity.
Let me tell you something, folks. Anybody asks you for any personal information, unless you absolutely know beyond a shadow of a doubt that these people are legitimate, absolutely, and I mean know them well, don't give them your personal stuff. Don't give them your information. You're just looking for a major hassle. Joan, have you ever spoken with anybody who's had their identity stolen?
No, I mean I've read and heard about, but I don't know anybody personally.
I have a friend whose wife had her identity stolen.
Oh no!
And it was a 4 or 5 year nightmare.
I believe
an unbelievable nightmare.
Huge nightmare.
Yeah. Oh yeah. yeah. It's just it was yeah. it's awful. And so, folks, you just don't want this to happen to you.
Yeah.
And you know, you're right, Joan. The email, you know, as wonderful as email is, we really have to manage it judiciously. It's, you know, I think of it, Joan, like driving a car. You know, Joan, our cars are the most productive thing that we have, usually.
Right.
But it can also be the most dangerous thing we have.
Sure.
Every time we crank it up and start rolling, we are the world is offering up all kinds of danger for us. But yet we drive the car. Why do we do that? So email is the same way. We've got to use it judiciously, don't we?
Oh, no question about it.
And the Internet, anything like that. Joan, we're coming up on the break. And when we come back, folks, Kiplinger is pointing out that the U.S. Postal Service is going to be getting an overhaul pretty soon. And we're going to get her to tell us about that. And then we're going to move over and talk about what's going on across the pond. What's happening in Europe? What's happening in China? Kiplinger has a few things to say about that. Even a little bit about what's going on in Iraq. We'll talk about that right after these messages. It's 10 Till. Stay with us. We're back at 7 Till. I'm Jim Blassingame, the Small Business Advocate, and my website is www.jbsba.com. Don't forget to subscribe to my free newsletter when you get there. Joan Pride is our guest. She's senior editor with the Kiplinger Editors. Joan, you guys say on page 4 that Europe will provide fertile ground for U.S. businesses in 2004. Now, I'm assuming you mean companies who are not doing business with Europe, but are actually posted, actually domiciled, or maybe not domiciled, but have divisions in Europe doing business as a European company.
That's my understanding, yes.
Yeah, and I see that. But here are the words you use. Thanks to an economy in recovery and a euro that's still strong. Now, let's talk about the euro in a minute. The economy in recovery, they're going to grow at 1.8% in 2004.
Well, it's better than not growing.
Yeah, I guess so. But that's less than half of what the U.S. is going to grow.
Yeah. And that's something that Europe has been, as you know, very, very worried about for
right.
quite a while now.
Right.
And they're a little jealous of our weak dollar.
Speaking of which, Joan, now this is, I had not thought about this until I looked at this wording here. Think about this, Joan. A U.S. company in Europe can export U.S. goods into Europe to sell into Europe, and because of the dollar, they can actually take advantage of that buying power
exactly.
for the products that they sell in Europe.
Right.
How about that? So a U.S.
Yeah.
company can actually use the dollar to, in other words, whereas an importer, if they were in the U.S., their units that are posted in the U.S. that are importing from Europe, they're not getting a good deal. It's costing
right.
them money. So this might actually be, I can see where maybe some companies – who have been on the verge of launching installations in Europe might actually make the step now.
I could see that too, yeah.
Very interesting. Yeah. Joan, China, according to Kiplinger, is moving to buttress its lending institutions this year. They got big problems over there, a la Japan, I think.
Well, I was just going to say, I hope they looked at Japan and figured out how not to do it.
It's too late, Joan. It's too late. It's already happened.
Well, I know, but we're saying that they're moving to clean out bad loans.
Hopefully.
And guard against making bad new ones.
Yeah.
So we'll see. I mean, we hoped that Japan would do that, and they kind of dragged their feet. So we have to hope that China doesn't take a page from their playbook.
I saw the Japanese bank bad debt number again the other day, and it absolutely – it's the second time I've seen it, and it took my breath away both times. Do you remember what it is?
No.
$1.3 trillion in bad debt. That's not their banking assets, folks. That's the bad debt alone. Now, Joan, put that in perspective. That is over 20% of the U.S. gross domestic product.
Wow, over 20%.
Yep, yep. And it's a much bigger chunk. Obviously, I think maybe 40% or so of their own. Gross domestic product.
That really boggles the mind.
It really does. I mean, it tells you how. Well, I mean that. I mean, we think we got problems with the Social Security. I mean, that's just awful. And what a lot of people are worried about is that China's advent into the free market economy business could be hurt by their the direction that they're going in.
Well, sure, yeah. Just as they're emerging as a free trading partner.
Right, exactly. Joan, let's move down and talk about Iraq. I had Rich Galen. You've heard me speak of Rich Galen before.
Oh, yeah.
Rich is in Iraq right now. He's actually based in Baghdad.
Oh, he's going to report from Iraq.
He reported this week. He gave us a report, and it was very good. He says that he's very excited about it. He says it's still a dangerous place over there. But he's very excited about the possibilities that are ahead for Iraq.
And he's looking at a lot of the small business growth and opportunity there, right?
Exactly. He says that they're very excited. He said that there is a lot of commerce going on in Iraq right now.
I'll bet.
Isn't that great?
Oh, it's nice to hear.
Well, and you know, one of the things that you guys point out is something that we know, and that's that the government in Iraq is going to take over by June 30th.
That's right. That's what we hope. Well, we're hoping that will happen.
It's supposed to happen. The question, though, Joan, is whether it's going to be what kind of a government it's going to be and how effective.
You mean
it's
a directly elected government?
Yeah.
Or
an appointed one.
And there's a lot of Iraqi religious leaders who are pushing for the direct elections, so that's going to be a big controversy going forward.
That's so the Shiites can be in control because they're the majority. And
of course,
we
the Sunnis are nervous.
We don't need that. Well, everybody's nervous. We don't need that at all.
No.
Joan, thank you for being here. Good job today.
Thank you, Jim. Okay, I'll be back next week.
We'll see you next week.
That's all right.
Yeah.
Okay.
Thanks. Oh, by the way, Joan, who's going to win the Super Bowl?
The Washington Redskins.
You don't even know who's playing. I got to go for this hour. Before I do, I'm Jim Blasnick. I'm sorry. That was too good. I'll see you later.
Insperity presents the Small Business Advocate Show with Jim Blasingame. This is a copyrighted production of Small Business Network, Inc., intended for the private use of our audience. Except as otherwise provided by copyright law, all other copying, redistribution, or publication without prior written consent is prohibited. All rights reserved.